Okay, we are past 7 o'clock. I think we're going to go ahead and get started here on our quiet little sparsely attended public forum here. Wow, what a response here. We've got people flowing outside. Thanks, everybody, for being here, and we do apologize for, you know, the capacity of this room, but we've done our best to make sure that everyone can not only hear but do have also the opportunity to at least submit their questions for us to possibly ask our panel. Welcome to the fracking forum here at the Norman Public Library tonight. As obviously everybody who's here knows, fracking is a controversial issue here in Oklahoma. On one hand, a lot of folks blame fracking for the recent upticks in earthquakes in Oklahoma, but at the same time, our state is certainly very much dependent on the oil and gas industry and fracking in our economy. And, of course, here in Norman a few months ago, there was some particular controversy whenever a drilling operation used a fire hydrant here in town using the city's drinking water to do this, and it caused somewhat of an uproar here in town. So I think it's good that we're having this public meeting tonight to make sure that everybody gets their answers to their questions. And we don't have a lot of time, so I do want to go ahead and get started. But before we do, I want to thank everybody again for being here and thank our sponsors, the Scholar Strategy Network, Sierra Club, Red Earth Group, Clean Energy, Future Oklahoma, and Our Earth for sponsoring the forum. Also, particular thanks to Cynthia Rogers and the steering committee who planned this, Casey Holcomb, Mary Francis, Karen Chapman, for inviting me to moderate. I'm Logan Layden with State Impact Oklahoma. So let's go ahead and get started with it tonight. We're going to have about 15 minutes worth of presentation from each of our panelists here, and then we're going to open it up for audience questions. I believe everybody had the comment cards there and were able to get a question on there, and we will pick through those and find some good ones to ask the panel after they've made their presentations. A reminder that this is going to be airing most likely on KGOU next Monday morning at 11:30, and so we want to make sure to keep it as civil as possible while we're in the room this evening. So I don't want to be rude and have to, you know, kick anybody out or anything like that. But joining us tonight on the panel is Dr. Bob Poles. He's director of the Oklahoma Water Survey and associate professor for the College of Atmospheric and Geographic Sciences at OU. And I believe you do teach a course on fracking at the university, right? So, yeah. So thanks for coming join us this evening. Also, Leah Messner is here. She's an assistant city attorney here in Norman. And I think you can answer some of the questions people might have about what Norman does to regulate the oil and gas industry, or what it's able to do, what it can do, what's within the realm of possibility here in Norman. And also, lastly, from upstate New York, we have David Slotjay. He's with the Community Environmental Defense Council. He's an attorney, and he has helped communities in upstate New York that have wanted to ban fracking do just that. So welcome them, our panel here. Like I said, we'll have presentations from each of our panelists. Let's go ahead and start with Dr. Poles.
Is this on? Yep. Okay. Before I get started, I wanted to, first of all, make it clear that the opinions that I express here tonight are mine and not those of the University of Oklahoma. These opinions are based on my experience in working in this area for the last 5 years, 2.5 years here at the University of Oklahoma, and prior to that, I worked for the Environmental Protection Agency's research lab in Ada, Oklahoma, which focused on groundwater remediation and groundwater protection. The last 2 years in working there, I was the technical lead for the EPA's national study on hydraulic fracturing and drinking water resources. In that role, I had occasion to work with all of the stakeholders involved in this issue, industry, state and federal regulators, private well owners, NGOs, and other organizations. I've interacted in my career with the U.S. Geological Survey extensively, also here in Oklahoma with the Oklahoma Geological Survey, and also with the Oklahoma Corporation Commission, which regulates oil and gas operations here in the state. And I have the utmost respect for the individuals in all of those organizations in terms of what they do, in terms of fulfilling their responsibilities for those agencies and their service to the public. In addition, I've worked on projects with the city of Norman. Several years ago, when I was with EPA, I worked on a project here with the city looking at arsenic in groundwater here in the central Oklahoma aquifer, looking at the assessment of where that arsenic was coming from within the geologic formations, and also different means of mitigating those arsenic levels. More recently, I've worked with the city on wastewater reuse. And I have to say, Norman is blessed to have excellent staff in their water utility program, water supply, water quality, wastewater treatment. So having said that, if I can have the next slide, I wanted to initially get everybody on the same page in terms of terminology, because sometimes there can be confusion over this. So this graphic represents basically a horizontal well that's been drilled deep to access a shale formation. In the bottom, you're seeing basically five frac stages in this horizontal well. What's blown up there is the different casing that is used. The purpose of that is to isolate freshwater resources from the oil and gas areas. Hydraulic fracturing is, strictly speaking, it's the process of injecting fluids under high pressure into a targeted formation to create fractures that then enable the release of gas and or oil. And a proppant is also injected along with those fluids to hold those fractures open that then allows the oil and gas to flow into the wellbore up to the surface and be recovered. So one of the things that's done to protect fresh water are these different series of casings. Typically you have shallow conductor casing followed by surface casing. Surface casing is the main casing that protects the freshwater zone. And each state has its own regulations in terms of how deep that surface casing goes below the freshwater zone. And then there's intermediate casing. Often that is used to isolate other zones that may contribute to freshwater or groundwater contamination, things like shallow methane zones, for instance. And then finally, the production casing, which goes all the way down to the reservoir, the targeted formation that's going to be fractured. Next one. So the hydraulic fracturing is just one part, one piece of the whole oil and gas production process. And this is a graphic that I've borrowed from EPA, their national study. Basically, in that study, they're looking at what they call the entire water life cycle during oil and gas production, from water acquisition, where the water is obtained to do the hydraulic fracturing, chemical mixing, what happens with the chemicals that are brought on site to be mixed with water and sand, the actual injection or the hydraulic fracturing, flow back and produce water. Once that pressure is released from the fracturing operation, then some of the water that was in, some of the fluids that were injected come back to the surface. And it's those waters that then have to be managed and finally disposed of in some way. Horizontal wells are basically a fairly recent development. Hydraulic fracturing actually has been around for decades. We've been hydraulically fracturing wells for decades. In fact, the very first commercial hydraulic fracturing operation was done here in Duncan, Oklahoma in 1949. And the issue really with the horizontal wells is they've enabled oil and gas companies to access a much greater volume of the reservoir. So, for instance, in the Marcellus, a horizontal well can intercept 2,000 to 6,000 feet of the formation laterally, where that formation that's targeted may be a few hundred feet thick, whereas a vertical well in the past may be only intercepted 50, 100, 200 feet. The other thing about horizontal wells, they allow for multiple wells on a single well pad. And this is actually a good thing in terms of the footprint that exists on the land surface, in terms of reducing the impact to the surface from things like traffic, lights, etc. So the horizontal wells really got developed in the 80s, but they really didn't get implemented until the 90s. First implemented in the Barnett Shale in Texas, and then in the Woodford Shale here in Oklahoma in the mid-2000s. In terms of risk pathways for water resources, really, it's my opinion and the opinion of many people, actually, and it's based by a lot of data, is that the main risk pathways to water resources are going to be from the management of those wastewaters on the surface, how they are handled, how they are managed, how they are transported, how they are eventually disposed of or treated. The other risk pathway is the production well itself. If the casing and the cement jobs are not done properly on the production well, they can leak. And if you have things in shallower zones, such as methane, they can move up the what's called the annulus, which is the space between the casing and the formation where the cement is supposed to fill. So there have been instances where that has happened. In terms of risk from hydraulic fracturing itself, the actual fracturing of the formation with the injection of those fluids and chemicals and sand, there's never been anything documented where that process, which usually takes less than a week, has actually impacted any groundwater resource. So really the two factors that I see our risks are pit leaks, spills, wastewater disposal practices, and inadequate well construction. I want to talk a little bit about what produced water is. Basically, it's water that comes to the surface with oil and gas following completion. Completion meaning they've done the hydraulic fracturing, they've installed the infrastructure to collect the oil and or gas, and now what comes up is oil and or gas, but also water. Now, initially, when that pressure is released, sometimes they refer to that produced water initially as flowback water, because you do get a bigger slug of water coming up over the first short period. And that water has lower total dissolved solids in it, as a higher percentage of the chemicals that were injected, and then over time that shifts and you get a greater percentage of formation water. Even in shale, which is highly impermeable, that's why we fracture it, there's water there. So what comes up is basically high salt content, oil and grease, composites of many hydrocarbons and other organic materials, some natural elements can come up from the formation, things like iron, manganese, arsenic, and the chemical additives themselves that have been injected into the subsurface. This is something taken from Gregory et al. In 2011, basically showing just an example of the kind of the chemical constituents of different types of produced water. From low meaning low total dissolved solids to high, high total dissolved solids actually approaching the salinity of seawater. So the things that typically you're going to be looking for if you're looking for an impact are going to be things that are basically in this table, TDS, chloride in particular, and some of the other elements. Stray gas is another term that often you hear, and that it refers to the presence of methane and or other gases, ethane, propane, that moves from one location to another. And incidents of stray gas have been observed in some parts of the country, basically from a failure of the cement or the casing surrounding the wellbore. And this gas often is not coming from the frack zone. It's often coming from shallower zones in between the freshwater zone and the frack zone. And so if that well is not properly sealed, these gases can move upward along that wellbore, annulus, and access drinking water aquifers. So there's no health standards set for methane. The main concern is explosion hazard. So when you have methane in water, when it comes into contact with air, that gas will exsolve out of the liquid phase into the gas phase. And if you are in a confined space and you have very high concentrations of methane, there can be an explosion hazard. So different states have triggered concentrations in water for looking at that issue. In Pennsylvania, it's 7 milligrams per liter. If people's water has 7 milligrams per liter of methane, then the state will look additionally at that water because of the issue of the explosion hazard. In Wyoming, it's 5 milligrams per liter. In Colorado, it's 1 milligram per liter. And this is typical. Things like this vary from state to state. Next thing I wanted to talk about was the chemicals. More than 90% of what's injected is water and sand, but there is a variety of chemicals that are injected along with that water and sand, and they all have basic purposes. So there's biocides, corrosion inhibitors, iron control, cross-linkers and breakers to basically deliver the sand to the frack zone. Most of these things are there to prevent clogging, to allow delivery of the chemicals, to allow delivery of the sand to the frack zone. If you have corrosion in your pipe, or if you have precipitation, or if you have microbial growth, these things clog up the pipe, and then you can't get the oil and gas out. So this is taken from Frack Focus. Frack Focus is a voluntary registry that was set up by the Groundwater Protection Council here in Oklahoma City. Companies can put what they are injecting on this registry. Actually, many states now require operators to post this information on Frack Focus. And so what's shown here are some of those same chemicals in terms of their components. I've listed some of the typical ingredients. In this particular case, this is from the Marcellus. So you can see in red there, in addition to fresh water, there's actually recycled water that's mixed with the fresh water. And then a variety of different chemicals. And then their percent by mass on the right side.
We have about a minute or so left on presentation, Dr. Pauls.
So most of the chemicals that are used are of such low quantities that they're diluted to such an extent that if they do move out of the frack zone, there's very little risk. The real risk is how these chemicals are handled on the surface before injection and how they are handled in the produced waters. So state regulations are largely responsible for the regulation of oil and gas operations. And they do this based on their own unique characteristics of the resource in their state, including geologic, water resource, geographic, and demographic considerations. And I would say over the last 5 years, almost all states that are active in this area have made repeated updates to their rules and regulations based on outside recommendations. This is a table showing a comparison of different state regulations, looking at pre-drilling water well testing, looking at water withdrawals, looking at setback restrictions from buildings, and looking at setback restrictions from water sources. More and more states are going to pre-drill water well testing. I would note that Oklahoma has not thus far. So here's a summary of some of the states that have. They typically have a sampling radius that they establish from the production well, where they will sample domestic wells within that radius. Most of them sample all the wells within that radius. Some have a maximum. Typically, this is done within a year or less prior to any drilling activity. Some states recently have also imposed post-drill sampling on operators, such as Wyoming, Illinois, and Colorado. So here in Oklahoma, we don't have yet a pre-drill program. So if you are concerned, these are some of the constituents that I would test for. Those state programs have a fairly exhaustive list, and it's not cheap, but most of that's imposed on the companies. But these would be the constituents I would look at for comparison, pre-drill, post-drill. I want to talk briefly about water usage. This is from a recent DOE report 2 months ago. Basically looking at the Barnett and the Eagleford in Texas, the Fayetteville in Arkansas, the Haynesville in Louisiana, the Marcellus in Pennsylvania, and the Niobrara in Wyoming and Colorado. And basically the take-home message here is that the average water use for these horizontal wells is about 5 million gallons. And then I wanted to talk briefly about, put it in context in terms of water permits. So the water usage for hydraulic fracturing here in the state, they typically have to get a permit from the Oklahoma Water Resources Board. What's shown there on the left is the groundwater permits, and by a huge margin, most of that is for agricultural irrigation. In yellow is oil and gas, and that's about 3%. Surface water, mostly it's public water supply in blue, and again, oil and gas, it's about 1%. And then finally, I want to talk about what's happening now. I think even with this small percentage, oil and gas companies are increasingly looking at other alternatives to freshwater sources, things like treated wastewater effluent, stormwater runoff, brackish groundwater or surface water, and also reuse of flowback or produced water, or basically recycling. So I want to conclude with some thoughts. What I have seen is improvements of surface management of wastewater and chemical handling and well construction practices over the last 5 years, together with better regulatory oversight. And these activities can significantly reduce the risk to water resources. Recent state and industry initiatives are constantly improving state of the practice for environmental protection and transparency. We have a ways to go yet, however. Baseline water quality data is important for adequate assessment of impacts to water resources. One of the things that I ran up against in the national study was people would give me their data, but it was always data following oil and gas operations, and nobody had data before oil and gas operations. So this pre-drill water quality baseline data is important. And then the continued development of the recycling of wastewaters and the use of alternative water sources is important to minimize not only water usage, but also reduce wastewater generation and therefore the amount of wastewater that we have to dispose of. here in Oklahoma that would translate into reductions in deep well injection volumes. Thank you.
All right, thank you, Dr. Poles. Very interesting. I knew we'd been doing it for decades, but not since 1949. Very nice. Yeah, let's just keep on rolling along here. We only have until about 8:30. We can go an extra 10 or 15 minutes once we start a little bit late if we need to. But Leah Master, go ahead.
Good evening. Thank you all so much for having me tonight. I wanted to say initially I'm so glad the meeting's being recorded and going to be re-aired on Monday. Unfortunately, three of our council members had to offer to leave tonight in order to respect Open Meeting Act provisions that require a specific notice if a quorum of council is going to be present discussing city issues. So they will be catching it on Monday, it sounds like, and I'm glad that that's happening. I'm here tonight to talk to you about City of Norman oil well regulations, what we currently have on the books here in Norman. Okay. I have quite a few slides, so I will try to move quickly through them so we can get to all of them. Initially, as some background information, our first ordinance regulating oil and gas drilling was adopted here in Norman in 1983. We currently have 163 permitted wells in the city limits of Norman. 125 of those are active, 18 are inactive, 16 are injection wells, 3 are supply wells, and 1 is a commercial disposal well. In addition, we have 2 new wells that are still in the process of being completed. The next slide is a map of the location of all those wells throughout the city limits. You'll notice the 2 purple dots, one on the north edge of town and one on the south. Those are the 2 wells that are currently under completion. And the blue and gray dots represent City of Norman water wells with a 1,000-foot radius around all of them, just to give you all a little sense of scale. Turning to our Chapter 13 regulations, Chapter 13 of the City of Norman Code of Ordinances deals with licensing of occupations and activities, covers a variety of different occupations and activities. One of those in sections 13-1500 to 13-1523 regulate and license oil, gas, and mineral production. So that's what I'll be talking to you all tonight about. The regulations are intended to preserve the health, safety, and welfare of the citizens of the City of Norman. A well may not be drilled or operated in the City of Norman without a permit from the city's oil and gas inspector. In addition, a permit fee is required. Those were just increased by Ordinance 013-1457, which was effective just a couple of days ago on the 9th. A drilling permit is $5,000, and the annual inspection fee is $450, and you'll see the other couple of categories that we charge permits for underneath. The next section is 13-1501B that has a list of what is required documentation prior to permitting a new well. Things like the location of the well, the distance to all existing dwelling houses, the list of equipment to be used, a written plan for disposal of deleterious substances produced during operation is also required. Also, a copy of receipts reflecting notice to all property owners within 300 feet of the well site. There are some additional regulations under 13-1501C if you're permitting a well for substance disposal. A map of the well site that shows equipment to be used, location of pipelines, the access road, all water supply wells. Also, wells within the project area and those sections immediately adjacent shall be indicated by a status as plugged or abandoned, injection, salt water, oil, etc. And they have to have the following additional information. I'm sorry that it's small. It's a lot of information. Footage, location, derrick floor and ground level elevation, top of cement, things like that are required. Turning to the next slide, also still on the same topic, other required documents to drill or re-enter a well for substance disposal, copy of all electric, mechanical, sample, and driller logs, operation name for each well, and copies of all information supplied to the Oklahoma Corporation Commission and their approval for the well. 13-1502 deals with a blanket bond or irrevocable letter of credit that's required prior to issuance of a permit in the amount of $25,000. The oil and gas inspector has the option to increase this amount up to $100,000 with good cause. An example of what might be good cause would be a previous violation of Chapter 13. There are a certain set of conditions that are required to be covered in the bond or the letter of credit. Those are the payment of all fines, penalties, and other assessments, the restoration of streets, sidewalks, and other public property, removal of litter, trash, waste, and other substances, the restoration of the surface condition, indemnification of the city, payment of deductibles on covered losses, and compliance with all other terms of this chapter. 13-1502.1 is the section for insurance. Along with the blanket bond or the irrevocable letter of credit, an operator is required to supply proof of insurance. The policy must cover seepage and pollution, comprehensive public liability, including bodily injury and property damage. The city has to be named as an additional insured on the policy, and the policy must have an endorsement requiring a 30-day notice of cancellation of the city. One other thing to note about these insurance policies is that the city attorney's office reviews them prior to the permits being issued. The next section in Chapter 13 is 13-1503. That's the definition section. I went ahead and just included all the terms up here so you all could see what's defined in our ordinance. 13-1504 regulates the casing that you heard Dr. Poles talk about a little bit of oil, gas, injection, and disposal wells. In Norman, the surface casing must be installed to a depth of 1,000 feet below the surface or 200 feet below the base of treatable water. Our oil and gas inspector advises me that more often than not that the deeper depth is that 1,000-foot figure. It must then be filled with cement and allowed to set, and the casing is tested before drilling. They must provide a form to the oil and gas inspector showing results or give him the option to be present for testing. He also advises me that he is always on the site for that testing. If the casing ruptures, must take immediate action to repair and notify the oil and gas inspector. And that has not happened under the tenure of the current oil and gas inspector, who's been here about 13 years. Sections 13-1505 to 13-1507 discuss kind of how the site is set up and the requirements for setting up the drill site. Except in the Lake Thunderbird Basin or the Garber-Wellington Aquifer Recharge Area, earthen circulation pits may be constructed, but they have to be vinyl-lined. Operators are also required to construct and maintain dikes or berms surrounding the facility to prevent downward or lateral seepage. And then all waste produced in connection with the drilling or operating of the well shall be captured and retained in steel tanks and vessels and transported from the premises to a disposal facility. Section 13-1508 is again how the site is to be maintained and constructed. No accumulation of litter or waste is allowed. The operator must restore the street sidewalks and vegetation, which may be disturbed or damaged. All lines must be buried 3 feet deep and must be pressure tested. And then all leaks and spills over 2 barrels must be reported to the oil and gas inspector within 24 hours of that occurring. And grass and weeds must be less than 12 inches in height. The next section, 13-1508C, deals with fencing at oil well sites. Any person who completes a well as a producer shall enclose the well and its surface facilities with a fence. Fence must be at least 6 feet high and constructed of a material and in a manner so as to be impregnable to children and animals under ordinary or foreseeable circumstances. However, when a well is greater than 600 feet from a dwelling or business structure, the oil and gas inspector has the option to waive that fencing requirement. Fences must be kept locked at all times, and the oil and gas inspector has a duplicate set of keys for all the well sites. 13-1509A discusses where oil well permits may not be issued within the city of Norman. on sites containing 10 acres or less, unless there's written consent from the surface owner. If the site is contained or described in an approved final plat or in a certificate of survey subdivision, or if the property is zoned as parkland or as a planned unit development, PUD. No oil, gas, or disposal wells shall be drilled or operated in conjunction with drilling within 600 feet of a church or school or within 300 feet of a producing freshwater well. 131511 requires that all equipment and methods used at well sites conform with industry safety standards, and all drilling wells must be equipped with a master gate, adequate blowout preventers, flow lines, and valves commensurate with working pressures involved. 131512 discusses the storage tank specifically. They shall have earthen embankments constructed around them of sufficient size and height to be able to contain 1.5 times the volumes of such tanks. Currently, most of these are now metal with vinyl lining. That's the new industry standard in this area, and our two new wells that are currently under construction have metal tanks. No tanks can be located closer than 100 feet to a street, nor closer than 600 feet to a dwelling, business structure, church, or school, and the tanks shall be kept free of all liquids, vegetation, and debris. 131514 deals specifically with injection wells. They should be constructed so as to seal the injection zone from the upper portion of the casing. The lines have to be dug at least 3 feet deep and are pressure tested annually. And all water wells located within a quarter mile of any disposal well shall be tested prior to the beginning of disposal and then annually for the presence of deleterious substances. The testing is the responsibility of the operator and is done at the operator's expense, and it's conducted by a person approved by the oil and gas inspector. Typically, this is a third-party testing lab or firm. The next sections, 131515 to 131517, deal with lease roads, approaches, and routes to the well sites. This allows for safe ingress and egress of city and state personnel. And the oil and gas inspector, like I said earlier, has a duplicate set of keys. The minimum width of a lease road is 50 feet with a 15-foot radius for approach, large trucks coming in and out of these sites. The operator must identify the type of vehicle, and the oil and gas inspector must approve the route to the site, and then the operator must use that approved route. 131519 and 131520 deal with plugging and completion of wells. The operator is responsible for plugging the wells in accordance with Corporation Commission rules, and they have to file a notice of intent to plug the well with the oil and gas inspector, and then file a completion report 30 days after the well is plugged. We have not had any wells plugged in Norman within the last year. Section 131522 talks about the authority of the oil and gas inspector. Like I said earlier, our current oil and gas inspector has been in his position about 13 years with the city. He is responsible for enforcing oil and gas ordinances and has the authority to issue orders as required to carry out the intent of the ordinance, and to enter and inspect any oil and gas well site within the city. 131523 is our penalty section, and the fines range from $50 to $200 per day that a violation exists. The last slide that I have for you is the status of oil and gas regulations in Norman. Currently, the City Council is scheduled to meet in a conference on August 26, 2014, to discuss ordinance amendments that primarily focus on fencing and landscape requirements at the well sites. Also, bulk water usage under a bulk water permit is prohibited during our Stage 3 conservation plan, which is severe, unless permission is granted by the city manager because of a substantial and unnecessary hardship. Bulk water sales account for 0.5% of total water used in Norman over the last 3 years, and the operators typically purchase one of these bulk water permits when drilling a new well. Thank you all very much.
Leah Messner, everyone. And I guess we do need to be finished by 8:30, so forget my earlier promise to go late, and let's move right along. Mr. Slajay, you're up. Your 15 minutes begin now.
I'm going to work from down there so I can advance my own slides. Probably this won't be necessary. Usually people can hear me.
But the radio audience.
Okay. My name is David Slajay. I'm going to speak today about using local land use authority to protect health, safety, and community assets from the risks of injection wells and high-volume slick water hydrofracking. And I'm going to speak very quickly, and I apologize, because I think we want to get right to the comments, and B, I'm going to deviate a little bit from what I had planned to talk about to address some things that have come up. I want to thank the Scholar Strategy Network and everyone, all the sponsors of this forum, for inviting me to participate. Just some quick housekeeping. What I am saying is for educational purposes only. No attorney-client relationship is created. I am the General Counsel of Community Environmental Defense Council. We are a not-for-profit public interest law firm dedicated to helping communities obtain the protective benefit of land use and environmental laws. I'm admitted to practice in Texas and Massachusetts and in New York. I want to make it crystal clear that I am not admitted in Oklahoma. And one of the reasons I want to make that crystal clear is there are a lot of people, including a fair number of people in this room, who do not want you to hear what I'm about to tell you today. And they are going to do whatever they can to make sure that you don't hear it. And if you do hear it, they're going to try to discredit what I say later. One of the things they would try to do is say that I'm guilty of unauthorized practice of law in Oklahoma. So I want to be crystal clear. I am not admitted in Oklahoma, and I am not somehow pretending that I am. All right? Very briefly, what I'm going to talk about is what municipalities in New York have been able to do recently to protect their communities from the impacts of unconventional drilling. I'm going to talk about what powers Oklahoma charter cities have, should they wish to consider enacting protective measures regarding drilling-related activities, including injection wells. And I'm going to tell you very briefly some common arguments that are made against enacting such protective measures. I realize we're in Oklahoma. I began my career in Dallas. I understand most people don't care what happened in New York. For most purposes, I don't care about what happened in New York. But some things that did happen in New York along the way, I think some of you will find very interesting. Before I begin, I want to ask, is Mr. Terry Stowers here by any chance? Good. Mr. Terry Stowers.
Stowers.
I'm sorry, sir. Now, Mr. Terry Stowers, according to this, is a Norman Mineral Owner attorney and the executive director of the Coalition of Oklahoma Surface and Mineral Owners. They are the group that distributed this list. And I'm going to come back to this during my presentation. But I want to read one thing before I start that Mr. Stowers is quoted as saying in here, if he'll have an opportunity to tell me he didn't say it once I said this. According to this, Mr. Stowers says, the Oklahoma Corporation Commission has exclusive jurisdiction to regulate oil and gas operations, and I'm quoting, any attempt to ban the fracking of a well by a municipality would violate the exclusivity to regulate granted by the legislature. I'm going to repeat that. The Oklahoma Corporation Commission has exclusive jurisdiction, and any attempt to ban the fracking of a well by a municipality would violate the exclusivity to regulate granted by the to the legislature by the commission. I'd like you to remember that. I'm going to come back to it. And I am willing to stipulate that the accuracy of virtually everything else in this piece of paper is of the same degree, and it's just as accurate as what Mr. Stowers told you, and we're going to come back to that in a minute.
That is an accurate quote.
He said it twice. He said it three times now. All right, very briefly, the New York State experience, there's a state statute in New York State that pro-fracking people says gives exclusive jurisdiction. I apologize to those of you I have my back to, over the siting of oil and gas wells and injection wells in the state. In 2010, my wife and I began explaining to people that notwithstanding that statute, New York State municipalities could use their home rule power, just like you have here in Oklahoma, police power. Police power is the authority of every municipality to enact laws to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the people within the municipality and to protect the property within the municipality. So that's what police power is. You have it in Oklahoma in the Oklahoma Constitution. But I'll get back to that in a minute. So we explained to people that they could use their home rule police power to pass local land use laws to prohibit within their municipal borders, not outside, waste injection wells and other fracking-related activities. As you might expect, there was strong pushback from the industry. Much more than this, although there was a lot of this, the industry told people that I had failed the bar 4 times. I've only failed it 3 times. No. I've never failed the bar anywhere in any jurisdiction I've taken it. But they said in writing that I failed it 4 times and other things to discredit us. Anyway, notwithstanding the threats, they went around, just like the bottom of this paper, although this is just a statement, not a threat yet, they went around and they told all these municipalities that were thinking about enacting protective laws that if they enacted those laws, they would sue the municipalities. And my grandmother always taught me not to point. But they would go in, I'm talking about industry representatives and royalty owner representatives, and they pointed at the various city council members and the town board members and said, I'm going to sue you personally, and you personally, and you personally, if you pass one of these laws. Well, by the beginning of 2014, almost 200 upstate New York municipalities, including every large city in upstate New York, had enacted a protective law, either a moratorium or an outright ban. Almost every, we worked with virtually all of those 200 municipalities, and virtually every case, people came in and threatened to sue the municipality, almost every single time. In fact, they only sued 4 of them, and all 4 of them won at the lowest court level. In New York State, the lowest court level is the Supreme Court. So the 4 that got sued, and by the way, none of those had to pay their own legal fees, either because they were pro bono lawyers like us, or insurance, or citizens came up. So one of the things they'll say is, even if you win the suit, you can't afford your lawyer's fees. There are pro bono lawyers out there that you can afford, because pro bono means you don't pay for them. All right. The question went to the highest court in New York, which is a court called the Court of Appeals, and just about a month ago, they came down and confirmed unequivocally that municipalities could exercise their home rule authority and enact land use-based prohibitions on drilling and related activities. So once again, what Mr. Stowers is telling you, is that Oklahoma municipalities do not have the legal authority to pass a protective law. He's telling you that the exclusive jurisdiction is with the Oklahoma Corporation Commission, and quote, any attempt to ban the fracking of a well by a municipality would violate the exclusivity to regulate granted by the legislature to the commission. Now, I'm sure Mr. Stowers is an outstanding attorney, but let's see what the law in Oklahoma appears to be as opposed to his opinion. So it is true that there is a state statute here, just as there was in New York, that says that the Corporation Commission has exclusive jurisdiction with respect to various oil and gas activities, including siting wells and so forth. But guess what the people like Mr. Stowers don't want you to know about? They don't want you to know about the Oklahoma Constitution, and they don't want you to know about some other things. We have seen, and he has confirmed, that Mr. Stowers is telling everybody you can't pass these laws. There are a few lawyers in Oklahoma who disagree with him. First of all, as I'm going to show you, there's a state statute that specifically contemplates that charter cities, at least, have the ability to both regulate and prohibit the industry. There's a state statute. Secondly, there are multiple, numerous, many, many, many Supreme Court of Oklahoma cases, which I'm going to show you. I'm going to give you cites, and I'm going to show you the quote, that say that Mr. Stowers, no matter how great a lawyer he is wrong on this one, okay? And lastly, so you've got the Supreme Court of Oklahoma, you've got the Oklahoma Constitution, you've got an Oklahoma statute, and lastly, we've got the Oklahoma Attorney General, who as recently as 2006 said Mr. Stowers is mistaken. So let's look at those. The Oklahoma Supreme Court has held, and by the way, I'm not an Oklahoma lawyer. I'm not practicing law in Oklahoma. I want to make that clear. I'm just reading the law, what it says. You don't have to be an Oklahoma lawyer, actually, to look up the cases and see what the Constitution says and what the Oklahoma Supreme Court says and what the Oklahoma statute says and what the Oklahoma Attorney General says. You don't have to be a lawyer to do that, an Oklahoma lawyer. So the Oklahoma Supreme Court has held that this exclusive jurisdiction that Mr. Stowers is warning us about does not take away the general police power of charter cities to provide for the safety and health of their inhabitants, and that cities, and I quote, do have the power under their zoning authority to regulate and restrict the real estate within the city limits for the development and production of oil and gas. Dr. Rogers, wherever you are, are these slides going to be available online somewhere? So good. So these will be available on the site. I'm not sure whose Scholar Strategy Network, I'm not sure where, but you'll be able to see these if you're interested and get the citations that I'm giving you here. You don't have to take my word for it. Okay, there's a state statute. It's actually the oil and gas law in Oklahoma. And that specifically contemplates that cities might regulate or prohibit this industry. The preamble, nothing in this act is intended to limit or restrict the right of cities to prevent oil or gas drilling therein. According to the Oklahoma Constitution and the Oklahoma Attorney General, probably a pretty good lawyer, I would imagine, a charter city may, and I'm quoting, deny an application for the drilling and operation of an oil and gas well located within corporate city limits, even if the Corporation Commission has authorized the drilling and operation of the oil and gas well. Now, this is why I brought up New York, even though I know nobody really cares about New York. This is exactly what the industry's representatives did in New York. They came in and they pointed at a statute. They told people that it meant something that, in this case, in the case of Oklahoma, it doesn't mean. It clearly doesn't mean. Says who? Never mind me. Says the Oklahoma Constitution. Says the Oklahoma Oil and Gas Statute. Says the Oklahoma Attorney General. And most importantly, says the Oklahoma Supreme Court. So you can rely on Mr. Stowers, however he pronounces his name, or you can look at what the Oklahoma Supreme Court says, and the Oklahoma Attorney General, and the Oklahoma Constitution, and the Oklahoma statute. But maybe he knows more than they do. Now, Norman is a charter city. Norman's charter gives the city power to promote the public health, safety, and welfare. That's the police power I talked to you about. Among other things, regulating the use of property, including exercising powers of planning and zoning. When a municipality exercises or attempts to exercise its police power, the standards are actually very favorable to the municipality. The standard is basically you have to be reasonable and you can't be arbitrary and capricious. Arbitrary and capricious is basically the lowest standard the law recognizes. I am not a lawyer in Oklahoma, but I am a lawyer other places, and it's the standard everywhere else, and it is the lowest standard the law recognizes. If you can't satisfy arbitrary and capricious, it's like falling off a truck, as long as there's some connection with what you're trying to do. You don't have to be right, because some things, there's not certainty on. But as long as there's a reasonable relationship with what you're trying to do, you will not be under the law. You will not be overturned. So let's just look at one thing. Forget fracking, because people can argue about fracking and what fracking means. And I'll get into this later. Let's just talk about injection wells. Let's say hypothetically that the city of Norman was interested in banning injection wells. So we would have to say, well, would it be unreasonable and capricious to ban injection wells, either because we were worried about the contamination or things that people care about around here, the earthquake risk. Well, let's see. The following is a screenshot that I took 2 days ago when I made these slides from Energy in Depth. Energy in Depth is basically the American Petroleum Institute. They are the industry. You can look at their site, Energy in Depth. Here's what they say about injection wells. This is on their site. It's the USGS. What we found is there is a link between disposal of wastewater and earthquakes. In many of these cases, it's been fixed by shutting down the well or reducing the volume. Sentence one, there is a link. So there are really straightforward fixes. In other words, yeah, it can cause earthquakes, but we can fix it because we can tell people not to put anything more down there. Also from their site, although the disposal process does have the potential to trigger earthquakes, not every disposal well triggers an earthquake. All right. So would the city, if it was interested in banning or restricting or even a moratorium, a temporary ban, injection wells, would they win a fight if somebody tried to say it was arbitrary and capricious? Without question. Without question. All right. Very quickly, typical arguments against enacting protective laws. The first thing people are going to tell you is if you do, and by the way, in New York, we're not allowed to regulate. We can only prohibit. The law is clear here, the Constitution, the state statute, the Oklahoma Supreme Court, and the Oklahoma Attorney General, as opposed to Mr. Stowers, all agree that you can both prohibit and regulate. And by regulate, I'm talking about things like setbacks. So you could say, you know, we're not going to prohibit this, but we want, say, a 2,000-foot setback or a 3,000-foot setback. The law is crystal clear in Oklahoma that you can do this. Crystal clear. I'm not admitted in Oklahoma. Now, the other thing they're going to tell you is that if you do something like this, you're taking their property rights. The people who say that, although I understand why they say that, those people are not familiar with the law. Here's what the law is in Oklahoma. It happens to be the law everywhere in the country, but I've just got Oklahoma cases for you. Property rights are always, 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 siempre, siempre, subject to limitation to prevent injury to rights of community and neighbors. I'm quoting now the Oklahoma Supreme Court. The right of an individual to use his property as he sees fit is qualified. It is not an absolute right. It is at all times subject to the authority of the state under its police power to promote the public health, safety, and welfare. I'm quoting the Oklahoma Supreme Court again with this slide. It's a well-settled principle that all property is held on the implied condition that it shall not be injurious to the equal rights of others to use and benefit their property. Think about that for a minute. The fact that you own property doesn't mean you can do whatever you want. Your right to do it, my right to punch this woman stops at her nose. I've got the right, but I can't punch her in the nose. You've got the right to do whatever you want with your property, but not if it hurts my property. That's not a taking. That's just how the law works in the United States of America. All right. The other thing they're going to talk to you about is legal fees. They're going to tell you that, okay, you can't afford this kind of lawsuit. We've got big lawyers. We got fancy lawyers. We got expensive lawyers. And if you pass one of these laws, we're going to sue you. And even if you win, because this is what they said to all of these towns in New York, even if you win, you will be bankrupt by the legal fees. Guess what? There are lawyers who will defend you for free. All right. The next thing they're going to tell you last thing is takings. I hope someone asked me a question about takings. My time is up. But I want to conclude with my friend Mr. Stowers again. This is basically a threat that if anybody decides to pass one of these laws, they are going to get sued for zillions of dollars in takings liability, which if I get the question, I'll answer when I get up there. It would be, quoting, it would be unwise for the city of Norman to expose itself to hundreds of millions of dollars in damages in a reverse condemnation, that's a regulatory taking, by tens of thousands of Oklahoma mineral owners. So he says, if the city's concerned, it should voice that concern to the Oklahoma Corporation Commission because only they have exclusive jurisdiction. Again, The Attorney General says he's wrong. The Oklahoma Supreme Court says he's wrong. The Oklahoma Constitution says he's wrong. And the state oil and gas statute itself says he's wrong. Thank you.
I know it deviates from the plan a little bit, but since Mr. Stowers was called out personally from the audience here, I do want to give him a chance to at least give a short response here. We do have to get to audience questions, but I do want to give you a chance.
Well, I won't go through all of the reasons why I disagree with our speaker from New York. I do disagree. I believe, and if we want, we can brief this one if you'd like, but certainly home rule is not unlimited. It is bound by and has to be consistent with and subject to the Constitution and the laws of this state. So, yes, the city can regulate consistent with and in addition to the Corporation Commission, but it can't be counter to that. The Supreme Court has clearly said that where there is a conflict with the general laws, then the home rule has got to be, let me just read it, where the legislature has made or may by general law make a specific police regulation, that fact of itself will not prevent the lawmaking power of a city from making further regulations on the same subject. And here's the important part, not inconsistent with the general laws. A municipality may move in the same direction as the legislature, but not contrary to nor in the opposite direction. So there is limits.
Those were the very arguments that the Supreme Court of Oklahoma had before it. And applying those concepts, even with those concepts, that's when they said on multiple occasions, this is not one some one-off, that in the context, we're not talking about in a vacuum, in the context of either regulating or preventing this industry, they said it was okay. The Oklahoma Supreme Court said it was okay.
Well, I noticed that you did not tell this audience about the most two recent Colorado decisions.
You want me to talk about Colorado or Oklahoma?
Okay. All right. That deviated a bit from the plan. Folks, the purpose of this tonight, more than anything, was to get audience members' questions answered, and we do want to get to that before we run out of time here in about 20 minutes. And so let's go ahead and get started with that. We have a question here. It says, I'm a homeowner in Norman and a mineral owner. What would a home rule do to my ownership rights?
I don't understand the question. So assuming, for example, that the city of Norman exercised home rule authority to, let's say, impose setbacks. Let's say it's sort of a broad question, so I'm just going to guess what the writer intended. If the exercise of home rule took the form of, say, imposing setbacks of, let's say, 3,000 feet, I'm picking these numbers, and maybe with certain sensitive receptors, such as schools and things, might have said 5,000 feet, whatever it is, my reading of the law, I'm not an Oklahoma lawyer, is that it wouldn't, I'm not really sure of the question, but that would be allowed. If that's a question to say, would that be a taking? No way that would be a taking. Let's say that the city of Norman exercised its home rule authority by doing a moratorium. I don't want to use the B word, ban, on injection wells in the city. And obviously, you can't do that retroactively, so it doesn't change anything that's already here. We're talking about prospectively or new injection wells. That wouldn't affect anything either. There is no way that would be a taking. So if the question is, would exercise of home rule constitute a taking, I would need a more specific example, but under the two that I just gave you, that is not a taking. And by the way, the question of a taking, even though there's an issue in the there's a concept of a taking in the Oklahoma Constitution, as there is in everybody's constitution, except I don't know about Louisiana, but in everyone else's, I just don't know Louisiana. It's really a federal question. So even though I am not an Oklahoma lawyer, I am very confident. The question of takings, by the way, is phenomenally complicated. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that it is among the most very most complicated issues it deals with. I have read every single takings case that has ever come before the United States Supreme Court, and I understand them. So if we get to it, and I hope we will in a minute with the right question, I will explain to you what a taking is and what it isn't, and why the assertion in that letter that you all got about the takings is no more accurate than the assertion that you that only the Corporation Commission has jurisdiction to do this regulation. And again, in New York, we don't have the option of regulating. All we could do was prohibit, because our analog to the Corporation Commission, our Department of Environmental Conservation, only they can regulate. But you can regulate. So you can do things if you want to do something less than a ban. You can do things like setbacks and the like. Who says? It's in the Constitution. It's in the statute. The Supreme Court has said it. Your Supreme Court has said it multiple times, and your Attorney General has said it as recently as 2006.
And Leah Messner, this person says they have 12 wells in their area now, and wants to know if there's a limit on the number of fracking wells per square mile in Norman.
There is not a limitation like that in the city code. I think that's regulated by the Corporation Commission.
I see. And also, how many wells have been plugged in the city since 1950? Unproducible wells have been plugged.
There are currently 18 inactive wells in the city of Norman that we have in city records.
I see. And Dr. Pauls, I think this one would go toward you. Does the water used in fracking in any way diminish water that's available for domestic and agricultural wells? And where does the water end up? So does that take away from what's available for other purposes?
No, I think what I showed you was a comparison of the water use for different sectors, and by far things like public drinking water and agricultural irrigation take the most water. Oil and gas operations take a very small percentage. I think Leah quoted 0.5% here in the city. Statewide, it's a little higher than that, but not much. The problem can arise here in the south and southwest in periods of drought. So industry has, a couple years ago, when we were in the middle of an exceptional drought, there were some situations where it was difficult for industry to obtain the water they needed during that period. And I think that's one of the reasons they've looked more closely at water reuse, water recycling, and alternative sources of water, because actually they don't need to use fresh water to frack a well. They have developed recipes and chemicals now that actually can avoid the use of fresh water.
I see. And now, Mr. Slaji, you might be able to answer this one. If the chemicals used in hydraulic fracturing are safe, why is it that companies keep them confidential? Because this is something that actually in our reporting has come up a little bit, and you wonder, all these companies seem like they're successfully fracking with their various, you know, ideas to do so. So why keep it secret? What does that do?
I am going to answer that question, but I first want to the doctor's slides showed that as a percentage, the oil and gas sector, the fracking, used 1%. I guess it was 0.5% in the city. Your slide said 1%.
1% for surface water, 3% for groundwater.
Okay, so 4%. That doesn't sound like a lot. But the difference between that and, say, agriculture or drinking water is that when agriculture uses the water, when you use it for drinking water, when you're done, you pee it out. And when the agricultural people are done, it goes back. And it goes right back into the hydrologic cycle, and it goes back into the sky, and it falls down again eventually. When this industry uses it for fracking, it is removed permanently. The water is literally destroyed. It's taken out of the hydrologic cycle. Again, 5 to 8 million gallons. And anybody who says it's not, then we got a real problem with those underground injection wells, because if they're saying, no, it's not removed permanently, where is it? Now, I want to talk about, this is my answer to the question. I want to talk about Dick Cheney for a moment. Dick Cheney had two things to focus on. He had two signature accomplishments by his own statement of what he did when he was in office. One thing he did was protect us from terrorists. You might agree, you might not agree whether it was effective, but that was one of the two things he focused on. The other thing he focused on, I want to tell you about something called the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act. The Federal Safe Drinking Water Act has one purpose and one purpose alone, and that is basically to protect underground sources of and potential sources of drinking water supplies. And the minute you do anything, you poke a hole, it doesn't matter if it's a septic system, it doesn't matter what we're talking about, that's governed by the Safe Drinking Water Act. Now, Mr. Cheney's other major accomplishment, in addition to protecting us from terrorist threats, and I'm not being facetious about that, he did it. Might have gone more than some of us, but he did it. He did was one thing. Some call it the Halliburton loophole, but it was a Dick Cheney. He single-handedly brought about an exemption from the Safe Drinking Water Act for the fracking process. Now, sometimes when legislation is passed at the state level or the federal level, the legislators, frankly, don't know what the heck it was. The lobbyists come in, or the people who really know in the legislature say, this is what we want. And when somebody sponsors a bill, they may or may not know what they're doing, frankly, at the state level, at the federal level. Dick Cheney knew exactly what he was doing. Dick Cheney used to be the chairman of Halliburton. So he knew exactly what he was doing. And he says, by his own admission, that the number two signature accomplishment that he had was exempting the fracking process from the Safe Drinking Water Act. Now, if there's no reason to worry about fracking in the water supply, why did either the second most or, let's say he's the second, at the time, the second most powerful person in the free world, why did he spend his time making sure that fracking was accepted, exempted from the Safe Drinking Water Act? Now, you may say that that doesn't prove anything, just like it doesn't prove anything that all of a sudden we've got a zillion earthquakes. Yeah, we had them before, but we got tons of them now with the injection wells. But I would ask you, he's a smart guy. You might like him, you might not. He's a really smart guy. Why did Dick Cheney think it was so important, since there's no problem here, in 2005 to carve out from the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act the fracking process?
I said, Dr. Paulson's earthquakes are mentioned. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the evidence either to support or refute this causal relationship between, I guess it's wastewater injection, right, and earthquakes?
Well, I'm not a seismologist, so this is not my area. I would say that it's quite anomalous that the amount of earthquakes that we've had lately. And I think the Oklahoma Geological Survey and the USGS are looking at this very closely to figure out exactly what the cause and effects are and how to manage that. And I know that they're both working with the Oklahoma Corporation Commission in that regard. But seismology is not my area.
All right. Well, I understand. Lee Messner, maybe you could address this a little bit. One of the biggest concerns we hear a lot from people who read our stories and listen to them is about how folks in Norman can be asked to conserve water while, a fracking company may use millions of gallons to frack a well. Could you maybe address that a little bit?
Well, like I mentioned earlier, bulk water sales account for 0.5% of the total water used in Norman over the last 3 years. Bulk water sales would not just be for oil and gas wells, but for construction sites as well. So it's a pretty small percentage of total water used in Norman over the last 3 years. I also have a figure for the new Barron well that's being drilled. They estimate using about 200,000 gallons of water over the life of the well. Mr. Jake is here with Bear, and I hate to call him out, but I think they're hoping to be here for 40, 50 years if the well's a good producer. So you think about 200,000 gallons over 40, 50 years is a pretty small amount of water.
Okay. Mr. Slajay, you wanted to address the issue, I believe, of takings a little while earlier. Why don't you go ahead and do that now, some of the complexities of that.
I explained that. So to put this in context, Mr. Stowers, I'm not trying to be flip. I really don't remember. Okay. Nobody can. I'm not trying to be rude, and I apologize. I'm just not trying to be rude. What he ends that little missive with is a statement. You might or might not take it as a threat, that if anybody has the temerity to enact one of these laws, there's going to be millions and millions and millions of dollars of takings liability. He called it reverse condemnation, but it's regulatory takings. Let me tell you very briefly what that is. Everybody knows the Constitution says, both the state and the federal Constitution, I am not an Oklahoma lawyer, but the Oklahoma Constitution, as well as the federal Constitution, says that if there's any taking of private property for a public purpose, you can't for a public purpose. Just compensation has to be paid. Most people know what eminent domain is. That's where the sovereign, the government, takes some of your property, either permanently or temporarily, maybe for a road widening or whatever. But there's a physical dispossession of the owner by the sovereign, by the government. And when that happens, when they move you off your property, temporarily or permanently, whether it's 1 inch or a half a mile, that's a taking. And no lawyer will ever tell you it's not a taking. What the lawyers fight about is the just compensation, and they fight like cats and dogs about what the amount is. A regulatory take, and there's nothing complicated about that. That is not what the Supreme Court was talking about. What Mr. Stowers is talking about is a regulatory taking. And very, very briefly, a regulatory taking is where a law is passed, there's no use that affects your property. The sovereign, the state, the government has not taken your property away, but they've passed a law. And whenever they do that, let's say that you wanted to, you had this piece of property, and you were hoping someday in the future to put a 16-story office tower on, and the city puts a limit on the property and says, in this district, you can only have a 4-story property. Everybody squeals regulatory taking. Okay, what the law is, and this is not. I'm not going to say this is crystal clear. There's nothing crystal clear in this area. But what the law in this area is if there's anything you can do with the property after this act, this law that is supposedly a regulatory taking, it ain't a regulatory taking. Okay? So, for example, let's just go back to our injection well situation. Somebody's got some property. They want they're not using it yet, in my hypothetical, for an injection well. The city puts, forget a ban, a moratorium on injection wells. There is no way under anybody's, under existing law, that that's a taking because there are other things you can do with it. I want to tell you a story. You don't want to talk about New York. I'm going to bring this back to Colorado and Oklahoma. The case, one of the cases that just got to the Court of Appeals is a town of Dryden. It's sort of a suburb of Ithaca, although Ithaca is a suburb itself. What happened in Dryden was a Colorado-based oil and gas company came in, and they spent $4.7 million buying up leases. We don't have split estates, so when you want to drill there, you lease the property. So you probably heard, some of you heard of this company. It's Anschutz Oil and Gas Exploration. It's Philip Anschutz. He is worth $37 billion. I'm sorry, strike that. According to Forbes, he's the 37th richest guy in the country. And I'll tell you why that's relevant in a minute. So they came into Dryden. They spent $4.7 million on leases. Then the town passed its law. All the while that the town was talking about passing its law, they were in there saying, this will be a taking. We're going to sue your pants off. You can't afford it. $5 million, we can prove we spent $4.7 million, et cetera. I told the town, that ain't no taking. Excuse me. I said, that is not a taking. They insisted it was. The town listened to us. enacted the law. All right, they sued. Now, of everything that's happened in New York State, the single most sophisticated player was the Anschutz Oil and Gas Company. Nobody can question how sophisticated they are in these matters. So they sued. They lost. They lost at the trial court level. Once they lost, their lawyer, who is, if you go to his web page, is a super lawyer. That's sort of a marketing thing, but it's actually a thing. He's a super lawyer. So keep that in mind. And you'd expect somebody as sophisticated as Anschutz to have a super lawyer. So they lost, and the super lawyer went all across New York State, because remember, the issue wasn't just that town. The issue was all of these towns and cities that were passing these. And he went in Albany, our capital, and all across the state on radio stations and said, we're going to appeal this, and we're going to file, my word, but the mother of all takings cases. Okay? Eventually, he did this for about 2 weeks. Anybody who would listen to him, if they put a mic in front of him, he said it. Eventually, he said, you know, we're not sure we're going to appeal. But whether or not we appeal, we are going to file a takings claim. And on my other slides I've got the quotes. And it will be a very, very large takings claim. So I'm running it short. He didn't appeal. They sold their leases that they paid $4.7 million for $10 to somebody and walked away, and they appealed, and they lost. When they lost on the appeal, it was the same lawyer. He said, we're going to file a mega takings claim. Well, they didn't. They went to our highest court. They lost there. They never filed a takings claim. Now, I can tell you, I spent my entire career representing people like the Anschutz people, folks like that. And I can tell you that whether you're a super lawyer or not, you do not leave $4.7 million of your client's money on the table if there is anything you can do about it. And anybody who thinks $4.7 million is not a lot to Anschutz Exploration, the way you get to be Anschutz Exploration is to worry about $4.7 million. So there is, if there was the slightest chance that anybody could prevail on that takings claim, they would have filed that suit. And they did not. And they said exactly what that letter said, and we said it ain't no taking. Now, you tell me. Now, the reason I talked about how rich he is, there are times when people have a legitimate legal claim, any kind of legal claim, where the doctor and I get into a fight, and I think that I have the right to sue him, and I think I'm going to win. I might not sue him, even if I'm certain that I'm going to win, because I might not have the money to pay the lawyer. So you could say, well, maybe the reason that Anschutz Exploration Company left $4.7 million on the table is because they couldn't afford to pay the lawyer. That is not why. They left $4.7 million on the table, and their super lawyer left $4.7 million on the table because they didn't have, excuse my French, a snowball's chance of hell of getting that money back. So it's a very complicated, we could do 2 hours on takings. But what you see in that sheet is inaccurate.
Well, unfortunately, we only have like 2 minutes left, so I do want to get in just a couple of last quick ones here. Liam Messner, you know, all this talk about potentially banning fracking, is this something that you see as possible here in Norman? Could Norman do this? Is it considering it?
No, I can't really answer whether Norman is considering it or not. I'm not sure the city council has current plans to take that up. I can't speak for them on that issue. As to whether or not we could do it or not, I think we've heard from two different lawyers in the room tonight that have opposite views on the issue, and my response would be that this is a really unsettled point in Oklahoma law, and I think that if we were to take it up and were to pass a ban on fracking or a moratorium, that we might get a legal challenge, and I can't tell you for certain how it would come out. I definitely do more research and represent the city and the city council as best I could if they decided to take that position, but I couldn't tell you how a court would come down on that. And I think that we've seen recently that the Oklahoma Western District, I was reading a federal court case that's not for publication, but it's pretty recent, that they they agree with me that that's not a completely settled point in Oklahoma.
See, and lastly, I do want to talk to Mr. Slotjay just real quick, a couple of questions that came from the audience about the differences. You know, Oklahoma and New York, different places. We may, obviously, I think we do rely a lot more on the oil and gas industry for our economy here in the state. You know, what do we do? You know, if we start you know, banning fracking operations, wouldn't that hurt our economy more than it did in New York?
I want to be clear that I am not here to suggest that the city of Norman or any other municipality in Oklahoma ban or even do a moratorium on unconventional drilling activities, well disposal or otherwise. I am only here to tell you that when you hear from people like Mr. Stowers that you can't do this, that the Oklahoma Supreme Court says you can. And when you hear from Mr. Stowers that it'll be a taking, I would ask you to tell me why Philip Anschutz walked away from $4.7 million if this was a taking. As to what you could do, I'm not here to talk about that. My mandate from Scholar Strategy Network is to not, I don't, for this purpose tonight, I don't have an opinion on whether you should do it. If you did do it, are there other industries that would want to come down here? I'm sure there are, but that's not for me to say.
Very lastly, to Dr. Pauls over there, on kind of based around that in the industry today, how important is hydraulic fracturing to getting oil and gas today? If it weren't for fracking, how would we do it? Is it, how vital is it?
Well, almost all the wells that are drilled today, not only in Oklahoma but the entire U.S., are hydraulically fractured, and more of them are using horizontal drilling. So it's an essential part of the industry today.
Very interesting. Yeah, we see that clash. Thanks, everybody, for coming out. I wish we could have gotten to everyone's questions, but we appreciate you being here.
On the question of the Corporation Commission protecting, and I am in no way criticizing them. But if you go to their website, on the page that talks about oil and gas regulations, they talk about what they're doing with those regulations. Number three is protecting human safety. Let me finish. Number two is protecting the environment. The number one thing that they do, according to them, is protecting the mineral interests. That's their own website. Protecting mineral interests is number one. Human safety is number three.
Hey, guys, we got to close this down right now. You would do me a giant favor if you would at least stack a chair or two to make it easier for us. We have to be out of here at 9 o'clock. So thank you. Thanks, everybody, for coming.